This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Have you given any thought to the way you want to be remembered after you die? The concept of memorials is evolving. It's no longer expected quite as much that a river of tears be shed near an open casket at a small chapel. Instead, more people are asking to be buried at home, or to have their ashes scattered, or to even have celebrations and memorial paloozas in their honor. So what's the best way you can think of to go out on your own terms? Joining Cincinnati Edition to discuss are dual-certified thanatologist Cole Imperi. Welcome back, Cole.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Linneman Funeral Homes and Cremation Center president and owner Lewis Linneman. Welcome, Lewis.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And joining us on the phone is Fitting Tribute Funeral Services Director and owner Amy Cunningham. Welcome, Amy.
Greetings from Brooklyn, New York.
And we want to hear from you, too, in our listening area, 513-419-7100. Feel free to give us a call. We want to hear about any experiences that you or your family or your friends may have had in some of these alternative approaches to funerals and burials and end-of-life celebrations. We'll look forward to your questions and comments by phone, or you can email talk@wvxu.org or join us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those into the show as well. Lewis, you're the sixth generation to operate Linneman Funeral Homes and Cremation Center. Your family's been in this business for a long time. I'm wondering what you're seeing take place at traditional funeral homes like yours and the approach to some of the alternatives.
Yeah, so the biggest transition is obviously from traditional burial families to more cremation families and celebration of life memorial services. So absent of the body, subsequently, you'll need something to fill that space with pictures, video, food, drink, things like that to help celebrate and memorialize a loved one that helps touch and speak to the life that was lived. Most people who are familiar with funeral service or who have experience in funeral service have heard the conversation from a minister or a pastor about people tend to focus on the beginning and the end, and they forget about the dash. The dash is the life that was lived. And as funeral professionals, that's something that we can do a better job of trying to incorporate with the services that we provide for the families that come to us. And albeit a tragic circumstance or long-term illness, it's important that we recognize that it's not just about the decline in health, but it is more about the dash.
So how is your business evolving to address some of these desires from people?
So we have instituted life celebration centers at our facilities that are essentially not funeral home looking. They are modern in their design. They are comfortable. There are fireplaces. There are TVs and monitors available for families. We are trying to incorporate every little thing that we can think of, including bar service, catering detail, kitchen, stuff like that to help make sure that families are comfortable and that they can celebrate and memorialize effectively.
And Amy, your business specializes in alternative burial opportunities like cremation or even green burials. So what are you finding in Brooklyn that people want more frequently that may be out of the ordinary of what we typically understand about funerals?
I'm beginning to think of myself more as an experienced designer than I am a funeral director because just as Lewis stated, people are interested in authenticity and a way to grieve where they are deeply and sincerely involved in celebrating the life, expressing gratitude for the deceased, and wanting to memorialize through slideshows, stories of the life. And it's almost like there's a new kind of cemetery. And it's a living, breathing one where everyone's relevance and importance and their values are honored. Of course, the body is still an important part of any end-of-life ritual, and my firm specializes in earth-friendly, natural burial, where the deceased is not embalmed unless it's absolutely necessary, and placed into the earth in a natural way, sometimes without a casket at all, just wrapped in beautiful fabric, surrounded by flowers, and lowered into the cemetery soil on a pallet or a wicker tray or kind of a board.
Mm-hmm.
We also are seeing a rise in cremation as the rest of the country. 2016 was the year that cremation surpassed the rate of burial in this country, and everyone's adjusting to that.
Mm-hmm.
What's the most unusual request that you've gotten, Amy?
Well, this is old and also new. Some families want to sit at the bedside of their loved one after death and get accustomed to the new reality on a pace and schedule that is their own. So we're getting requests for delayed transfers. Most hospitals here, and I think elsewhere, will allow you 3 hours in the room after a death occurs. When death occurs in the care of hospice in a residence, I'm finding that families are asking, can we have a few hours? Can we sit here and tell stories, light candles, play music, be together? And that has become a new kind of viewing. It's like families are wanting to control more and have a peaceful moment after death in a place where they're most comfortable, and that's increasingly their residence when it's possible.
And Cole, you know a lot about death and death care and comfort at the end mm-hmm. of someone's life. So what is driving any perceived or actual shift in the way people want to be memorialized?
So I think just to broaden this out a little bit, so there's whenever somebody dies, there's two things. There's what are we going to do with the body, which is called disposition, and then there's the funeral rite. And the funeral rite is what we're seeing change, because I think in the past it's been more common where people thought that burial was a funeral, just what you did with the body was a funeral. And now the focus is more on personalization. Like Lewis said, focusing on that dash, and we can personalize best through the celebration of life, the funeral, the memorial service, whatever you want to call it. But there are three main driving factors in the United States that has really contributed to this sort of cultural shift that is happening. The first is moving. We're more likely to move away from where we were born and moving in different ways than previous generations did. According to CityLab, 60 to 74% of people age 25 and older in Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana are living where they're from. So we have to understand in this part of the country, we are different than, say, Nevada, where only 0 to 20% of people age 25 or older live in Nevada where they were born. So we are more detached from our communities and from, like, six generations of being in the same town. We are uprooted. The second factor is the rise of the non-religious. So 23.1% of the U.S. population is non-religiously identified. So those people don't call a clergy member, which we might do in Cincinnati, which is more of our norm here, to help us figure out what to do. And then the third factor is this blending or cultural shuffle. It's now, because we're moving, more common in a single family unit to have people from different parts of the country, different parts of the world, different religious traditions. And I've even seen within the same family, there isn't necessarily a common language that is spoken. So something that is meaningful to a family that has been German Catholics in Cincinnati for six generations is going to be different than a family that is from every area of the United States.
I wanted to ask about the connection of religion to these trends, because there are a lot of religious activities or traditions that have entered the mainstream, whether you practice religion or not. I mean, Christmas is an obvious choice of one. Mm-hmm. You know, just about everyone celebrates Christmas, whether or not they recognize or honor the religious symbolism and the religious ceremonies that are behind it. But when you think about burial, a lot of this is inspired by religious rites. There are things that take place graveside, where you
yes.
pray and things that have come out of the religious side of things. So I'm curious, and let me throw this to Amy. Are people who are seeking alternative burials, such as the green burial option that you offer, are you finding that they struggle to reconcile this decision with some of the religious expectations from their lives?
Absolutely. And it's a great line of inquiry. When I sit with a family today, someone is a Buddhist. Someone is going to yoga retreats. Another family member may be Jewish. Another may have been raised Catholic, and they're all in the same family system, sometimes trying to figure out how to honor a grandmother who was an atheist and didn't have any particular tradition at all. And they present themselves to me as mixed up and confused. And when I get a family like that, I just validate them and say, hey, guys, you are the new American norm. Mm-hmm. This is what we're seeing. And we can honor your traditions and the values of the deceased and create a fantastic celebration of life, a funeral service, and hit all these notes. So I find it an inspiring time. People are bewildered, though, when they first come in, because in the old days, clergy did everything.
Mm-hmm.
We're kind of needing other resources and seeking our own authority figures in the planning process, which is why blogs and information that Cole provides is just so valuable.
And Lewis, when you have a family come in who's dealing with a death, and they may not be a religious family, but maybe because of tradition or cultural expectations, they think, well, we've got to have a preacher. We've got to have some clergy member here to preside over this, to pray with us. How do you handle that?
As Amy mentioned, that is a very common thing that we're dealing with in the funeral profession today, is families of mixed religious backgrounds and cultural beliefs. And one of the things that we do when families come in and do not have a specific minister that or common person that they would like to perform the service is we at the funeral home actually have some life celebrants on staff that are trained and have prepared for the families that come to them to try and gather the information that they're wanting to collect and have in their service, incorporate it perfectly. So by the end, the minister is speaking as almost if someone from the family is doing the service on their behalf. They help capture all the elements that they're looking for out of a funeral service.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. People are saying goodbye forever in new and innovative ways. And we continue now with our look at trends in end-of-life services. We're joined today by dual-certified thanatologist Cole Imperi, Linneman Funeral Homes and Cremation Center president and owner Lewis Linneman, and Fitting Tribute Funeral Services director and owner Amy Cunningham, who joins us on the phone from Brooklyn. Our number is 513-419-7100. If you'd like to join this conversation, you can email talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those on the show. Connie is on the line. Hi, Connie. What's your question or comment?
Hello?
Hi, Connie. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I just wanted to say hello. Hi, Cole.
Hi.
I really agree with what they were saying about the and think good to hear about things coming around to more of a celebration of life. And I agree with Cole in the fact that it is dependent on where you're from and perhaps a religious background. I know when I was little, it was in our little, you know, West Side Cincinnati, you know, bubble, as we think of sometimes. Our religion was very much that you came together and it was a celebration of life, to the point that I remember thinking growing up that I would hear other people talk from maybe different parts of the country or different religions, and I was a little shocked or kind of thought like, oh, is that sound a little, would you say morbid or not respectful, that we would say it was like a family saying and some other, you know, West Side, you know, Roman Catholic families would say the same, that it was some of our best family gatherings were after someone, you know, sadly had passed away, but it was just unheard of that you didn't gather together. Like you went, it was a thing that you would have a 2-day, you know, you would have the viewing and then the next day would be the mass into the graveside and then back to someone's home. Now I think there's more of a trend like we did with my parents where we went to like the church under Croft and it was almost, you know, you had caterers, we have, you know, pictures out. And yes, we did do, you know, at the bedside. We had, you know, after my father and my mother both, a time that we wanted to say goodbye personally, there was a beautiful, you know, hymn song. But yeah, that was the thing. Like, you never went in empty-handed. You came to that person's home with, you know, whatever the local bakery pastries were, or casseroles or whatever. And that was the time you came together. And then we would spend the rest of the day after the graveside ceremony just laughing and talking and remembering that person.
All right, Connie. Well, we thank you so much for sharing that memory with us. Thanks for the call. We'll let you go and let the panel weigh in on that. You know, it's not unusual for funerals or memorials to bring families together. Certainly you want to come and pay your respects and you reflect on a person's life and all of that. But the catalyst for many of these, certainly in the past, and certainly my personal experience has been, well, there's something in the casket, maybe an open casket where you're going to see this person for the last time in a very strange way. How do we adjust culturally that expectation that when we're going to memorialize someone, that they don't necessarily have to be physically present?
Yeah, so one of the things that this has made me think about is, like, the whole funerary ritual itself predates funeral service. Our brains actually, to have healthy grieving, need to come together to be sad, basically. And that's been as long as humans have been living. And so today, in the U.S., we had this period of, like, 50, 60, 70 years where death was, like, take it away to the funeral home. And there are a lot of people who still want that and prefer that. But now the question is, well, how can we bring it back into the house? The house that I live in, Mainstross Village, I found some obituaries. There have been multiple funeral services in my home in the 1800s. That was the norm. And we had this kind of funny period, you know, recently where that never happened. And so when you're talking about an open or closed casket, some people think, oh my gosh, an open casket is so weird. But sometimes those same people, you're like, well, what if we kept your dad at home for a day after he dies? And they're like, that sounds so great. What is the difference, right? So part of it is just education. People need to learn more and understand more about what the options are, and the fact that funeral directors can help make all of that happen.
And Amy, what kind of conversations do you have with your clients who are coming in to plan an alternative funeral, again, maybe a green burial? Are you hearing from them at all that some of their extended family may have concerns about this because it goes against the tradition?
Yes, and I try to give everyone in the family a vote or an opportunity to express themselves and air their views, because sometimes when there's disagreement over what to do next, just being heard is so important. And people do come to a beautiful kind of consensus. You'd think that a funeral director would see a lot of family strife, and I guess I have, but really my overwhelming impression of the families I greet every year is that people are so, even when the relationships have been difficult with the parent or loved one, they're bidding farewell to, they rise above and assemble themselves in a magnificent kind of way that impresses me all the time. I really feel like a good funeral can send everyone in attendance out the door with kind of an uplifted worldview and a new sense of going forward, whatever it is. Even if it's a tragedy or a suicide, people through an end-of-life ritual can find themselves again and set off into the grieving year in a way that is life-affirming and inspiring.
Amy, I think that just to touch further on that, one of the things I'm sure you experience as you meet families who may not agree with or come together to an agreement for the services for their loved one, funeral service is very much a lot like wedding planning in some respects, in terms of you will always have a group of people within the family, within your community, that will not agree or come to it to be for mom, for dad, for their loved one. And ultimately, I tell people, take a step back, make sure that you have the right people in this room to have that conversation. And even more so, try and not be afraid to have this conversation ahead of time so that you're not brought to that end of clock, you know, we have to make a decision at this time, you know,
yeah.
that's where it's very important.
Because the person who is dying, it's great to know their wishes, but that person should keep in mind that the people that they leave behind, their loved ones, are the ones that have to deal with what's left. And so sometimes when I frame that, when I have conversations with people like, oh, you just want to be buried and have nothing. Well, how's that going to make your children feel and your, you know, aunts and uncles and cousins? What do they need so that they can grieve and move forward?
Well, and ultimately, it's not just the decision makers that are experiencing this funeral. It may be a grandchild that this is their first introduction to losing someone important to them.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to always keep that in the back of mind of what do you want their experience to be like? Do you want them to have that extended grief experience because of decisions that were rushed through or poorly thought out?
Yep.
Instead, take the time to have those conversations. That's
something I wanted to ask about for sure. Is there any concern about not recognizing or allowing for grief? I mean, grief is an important human emotion.
It is so critically important to make space and honor a loss or a grief, whether it's the loss of a person or the loss of like a marriage, a divorce. The brain grieves the same way non-physical deaths. And like what Lewis was talking about, they have this celebration center, right? Because a funeral is a big transition. A wedding is a big transition. A birth is a big transition for entire family and community structures. And anytime you have a big transition, there's a loss of whatever was before.
I want to read some comments that we've gotten. We got a call from Jeff, and he wants to know whether it's true that your body, when you die, can be turned into a diamond.
Oh, yes. I looked into this because I like jewelry. So looking at all of my aunts and uncles and saying, No,
really?
I'm just kidding.
Which
just
one
joking.
Could fetch the highest price?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, there's so many new options and things that you can do after you die. One of the newest is recomposition, now legal in Washington State, where you can become 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet of soil. Yes. So you can become a garden.
Wow, that's intriguing, I guess. But nobody knows for sure about the diamond. Has anybody heard about that?
Oh, yes.
Oh, wait.
There's
Amy.
A method in a company that does take cremated remains
and
put them under intense pressure. So much pressure that a crystal is formed.
Yep.
I have yet to have a family desiring that. How about you, Lewis?
We have had several inquiries for it. At the end of the day, it became a monetary decision because it is not a cheap process to go through.
What's the estimate?
I would say probably $5,000 to $7,000 is a good estimate.
You're right.
You're Amy, I'm sure you would probably agree with me on this. As we transition from traditional funeral service to more cremated celebration of life services, one of the things I've also discussed with families is, you know, having a place of disposition, a burial plot, a garden, a lake, wherever that is for your family, it would still be important to incorporate the burial as part of the process because down the road, you know, four generations from now, you know, as families are taking ashes home and keeping them, you know, do you want to have the wall of family on the, you know, in your residence or in your storage container, you know, so having a place of memorialization and remembrance is going to be important for future generations.
Yes.
And we got some comments on our Instagram because we're hip and with it and people comment on our Instagram. We asked if the family was planning a non-traditional funeral. We got a comment from @foreveryoung in kindergarten who said, my mom wants a natural burial on our family farm next to our buried pets. At the Holy Ordinary told us my dad is dying at home and we plan to have the wake and service there. He built his own casket. That must be a unique approach to know that your life is coming to an end and to build your own box there at the end.
In the U.S., but not in other countries.
Is
like
that right?
In China, part of when you hit about 60, it's normal to like build your own casket. And it's part of a like good luck thing to ensure a long life. So that's normal in other countries. In the U.S., we are a little bit odd, honestly, with how we deal with death and dying or prepare for it or don't prepare for it.
I imagine that has to do with the fact that our culture is just not as old as some of these other places, and we're this blend of all those other places that have come over here, relatively speaking, of course.
Yep.
At Andy Ellis 328 gave us the comment, my parents keep kicking around the idea of donating their bodies for scientific research, so there's that as well. At Kara in Kentucky told us, I told my mom that I'll eat just a bit of her ashes, like CS in Wild, and everyone is freaked out. Eye roll emoji. So I don't know if that's something that people are doing, consuming.
Yes. And in particular, just to be honest about this, I've read of women who lose their infant children.
Oh my gosh. Mm. Okay, I know we have to let our friend Amy go, but let's get another call in before we do so. We have Lucinda on the line. Hi, Lucinda. What's your question or comment?
Yes, my question, comment is I'd like them to expound a bit more. They briefly mentioned ceremonies for suicides. We, unfortunately, as retired military, had to deal with suicides of friends, even touch the family. And how can we, as support systems, help to keep that a positive, like they said, to celebrate the dash?
All right.
And I'll hang up and let them expound.
Thanks for the call, Lucinda. Appreciate it very much. So she's referencing suicide and how you would approach that in a fashion that is able to bring some positive out of such a tragic circumstance.
So one of the things that we do at our funeral home is we do our life story interviews of families and produce a life story pamphlet for visitors and guests that helps. Essentially, it's a shortened bibliography of the person that has passed. And while suicide is obviously one of the most tragic events families can ever experience, the life before that may have its complications, its challenges, and things like that. But we shouldn't shy away from the positive things that that person impacted in their life, the experiences that they enjoyed. We try to focus on sight, sound, and taste of family memorialization, whether it's favorite foods that they enjoyed, candy bars. We've baked pies for families who had baking background. You know, trying not to focus on how they ended up at the funeral home, but focus instead on the different
life they lived.
Yeah, the life they lived. Thanks, Cole.
Amy Cunningham is the Fitting Tribute Funeral Services director and owner. She joined us on the phone from Brooklyn. She's got to run, though. So, Amy, we do appreciate you taking some time and joining us for today's conversation.
Guys, I appreciate all of you. And, Lewis, your funeral home just sounds terrific. Cincinnati is so fortunate to have you. So, thank you, everyone. Great talk.
And thanks, Amy.
To be continued. Thanks, Cole.
Thank you,
well,
Amy.
Everyone. Take care.
And Cole Imperi and Lewis Linneman are sticking around. I'll get through a few more of these comments that we've gotten from folks who posted on our Instagram. At Samwise underscore Strikey said, parents want traditional, husband wants at sea, me, I want a tree. Mm-hmm. So a lot of different ideas even within the same family.
Yep.
So that must
be. And those
be
are disposition methods. None of those are the ritual. What type of funeral service? What type of memorialization?
Just where to put the body at the end.
Yeah, and they're two very different things. And I think that's the thing I try to educate people on is it's not just what do you want to happen to your body. It's how do you want to celebrate the life.
Yeah.
At Nikki No Kids says, I plan on talking my family into being open to the idea of a non-traditional funeral. So how does someone approach that with their relatives, especially in a religious family that may have certain expectations for what's supposed to happen to you in the afterlife, and there's one way to get there, and it's this way. How do you go to them and say, look, I don't want this traditional Roman Catholic thing to take place. I'd rather become a tree.
So the easiest way to do it, and I would encourage everybody, including our listeners, to consider having this discussion with your family. We encourage people. We have a thing at our funeral home called the Talk of a Lifetime, which is a deck of cards that ask different questions of family members, you know, from what was your favorite teacher growing up to your favorite sports experience, your favorite album that you listened to. And have those conversations when you're together at holidays, birthdays, and things like that. And ultimately, I encourage, again, our listeners to consider pre-planning and getting your thoughts on paper of what you would prefer to do for yourself and what your family might need. And that'll be the best way to have that conversation, or at least start it, to diagram what it's going to look like when it comes.
We got an email from Maria that says her family has begun a tradition of body donation to medical students. So there's one way to go. I'm curious about cost before we transition into our digital remains conversation, and the role that cost may play in either encouraging alternative burials or discouraging it. Lewis, what's the cost of a typical funeral? If I came to you and said, you know, my dad passed, we've got to plan this thing, how much should I expect to spend?
So traditional burials, including the third-party expenses.
And the casket.
And the casket and the vault and cemetery expenses, you might get to the $10,000 to $12,000 range.
So that's more expensive than the diamond.
Correct. But you're also dealing with a much different type of expense, including more staff, more work on the actual decedent, because typically they're laid out. So as soon as you remove the decedent, typically, you know, for our cremation families, you'll experience about half of that for cremation services, because you don't have the extra work that you have for preparing the decedent.
And Cole, do you know of the cost of some of these alternative options? Like, what are the ranges that we could expect if I wanted to be thrown into a bag and put under a tree in a yard?
I mean, honestly, you can spend a couple thousand, you can spend over 10,000. Depends on what part of the country you're in, what other options are nearby. It truly is a massive range. Here in Cincinnati, there are cemeteries here where you can be buried green for about, like, the plot itself, about $1,000, $1,500. You can also spend over $10,000 on a plot in a different cemetery.
And what about these bigger celebrations, these memorial paloozas we've heard about?
Yeah. So I'm working with a family right now. The person who died is a big person in their community, and they're expecting 400 to 500 people. They're serving food. They're bringing in a bar. They have a live musician. They're having the artifacts so that person loved laid out and around. And it's now becoming like a community gathering layered on top of funeral service, essentially.
So that sounds expensive, too.
It is expensive, but to that entire family unit and to that community, they're thrilled. They're looking forward to it.
I mean, if you just look at the average cost of weddings these days, I mean, people have no problem shelling out $15,000, $30,000 for a one-day, four-hour celebration of someone's nuptials. You'll have similar type of expenses when you're talking about saying goodbye to a loved one, because you have that same type of crowd that will show up to offer condolences and things like that. Yeah. So it can get costly between catering and everything else.
Wasn't it Al Bundy from Married with Children who said of the movie Four Weddings and a Funeral, isn't that five of the same thing?
That's
all right. What happens when we sign off from Facebook for good?
Ooh.
When we come back, should your digital remains get the same respect as your physical remains after you die? This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. When you die, you leave behind more than material things. Your Facebook page might still be up, or your personal website or blog. A timed tweet could be sent out long after you've expired. So what's the best approach to dealing with digital remains? We're joined still by dual-certified thanatologist Cole Imperi, and we also have Linneman Funeral Homes and Cremation Center president and owner Lewis Linneman here with us. And you can join us as well at 513-419-7100. So I think about Facebook, and Facebook has obviously accepted that some of its users die. They have a lot of pages that have transitioned to in remembrance of or memorial of profiles. But sometimes we get these little reminders of someone we lost on Facebook, maybe a notification about an aunt's birthday and she's dead. Or maybe we get some automatic post from Facebook that reminds us of a memory and it triggers something in us because maybe we weren't particularly ready to feel that emotion for this person who may be in this image or in this comment and they're gone. This is a quote from an article in USA Today. The an analysis by Oxford predicts that based on 2018 user levels, at least 1.4 billion members on Facebook will die before 2100, which would mean the number of dead there, the number of dead there on Facebook could surpass the living by 2070. And if Facebook continues to expand at current rates, the number of deceased users could reach as high as 4.9 billion before the end of the century. So how are these digital platforms, Cole, evolving to understand that people die and their profiles remain?
So the internet is a cemetery. It is totally a cemetery because when the internet was created, just like all of our social media networks and any sort of platform, none of these were built with a way to die. None of them were built. And so domains is the term. I coined that in my work in 2009. And since then, there's been so much more development in this area, which is its own specific field of study called thanotechnology, which was founded in 1997 by Carla Sofka. So thanotechnology, where death intersects with tech. Now, one of the problems and the biggest issue is that, at least in the United States, who owns dead people's stuff online, especially when I bet so many of your listeners have Facebook accounts they can't access anymore or websites they put up 8 years ago and it's archived and duplicated somewhere and it's out of their control. Who owns that? And what happens if you don't want it up? How do you take something down that you have no control of and no access to?
I wonder about the impact on just the health of those left behind.
Yes.
And if that's taken into consideration at all, or if there are ways for those people who are left behind to prevent themselves from being exposed to it.
Yeah. So there's something called a second death or a digital death. And the second death is when you disappear digitally. That's when you're really dead. When I Google Colin Perry and nothing comes up. And that is a concept that is very upsetting to a lot of people. And there's a theory that the whole reason the internet exists is because humans want to be immortal. And so we want to, that's ultimately what motivates why we post and write blog posts and put stuff up on a website and get into Twitter arguments, because it's like, we're here, we exist. And so a lot of, that's why it's theorized this entire thing, the internet was built without a way to leave it, because we don't want to die.
Lewis, are these questions that come up when people are planning their funeral? And I don't know if you would be equipped to have advice on this, when you're in your office and consulting with a family and they're like, you know, what are we supposed to do about these other things that are out there? How do maybe they want to incorporate them into the services somehow, or maybe they're looking for ways to take them down.
Sure. So it's not as prevalent in an at-need setting as funeral directors might use that term, just because they have other stressors that they're dealing with. So it's not in front of mind at that time. They're thinking of, you know, my loved one has passed. Here's what we need to do. And then from there becomes the estate planning and things like that. And so it's really, the digital footprint isn't really on the front of mind.
Yet.
But I certainly think that, and I agree with Cole, that just down the road past those times, probably, you know, 6 months in, that conversation begins to have, especially as Facebook is reminding and other social media outlets remind you of these memories.
We got a comment on Instagram about this topic that says, will deceased people's social media accounts become the cemeteries of the future?
Yeah, they already are. They already are. And there's actually some researchers who study, they did a big study on college students who have friends who died. And what the research is continually showing now is that we do not unfriend our dead because we feel like that's really rude. But what we do is we unfollow them, so that we don't see anything attached to them, because research shows that we find it distressing. What's unique, though, is about 3 years after the death of the friend, it becomes less weird to see the dead person's stuff online. We like get used to people being dead but living online.
Another comment on Instagram from @JaneWinget. She says, I converted my mom's Facebook to a memorial page because people wishing her happy birthday got hard because it showed they didn't know. I kept her Pinterest, though. It's nice to have that connection. So that's interesting that you kept one platform.
One thing, yeah. Well, and you know, some people get trapped in by the domains that are left behind by other people. For example, there's a woman I know of. She has a voicemail from her son. And she has not upgraded her cell phone for the last 6 years because she is doesn't want to lose that voicemail. She doesn't want to record it elsewhere. There are apps to save that voicemail. Voicemails is a domain. And so she's got this phone that is about to completely be obsolete, but she can't let go of it because it has that voicemail. And that, from a bereavement perspective, creates complicated grief. Like, you feel beholden to this digital file. Also, imagine if your partner is like a famous author who writes a lot of books and they die. Their fan base is going to expect that surviving spouse to deal with all of their files and all the stuff that they were working on, and they're going to expect them to finish it. And so there's this thing called legacy guilt. It's like a digital legacy that you inherit, sort of like when in a funeral home, there's assets, like someone's going to inherit a house, someone's going to inherit a business. Well, someone's also going to inherit all the stuff that people left online and left on their computers.
I just upgraded phones, and I have a voicemail from my aunt who died 4 years ago, and it was one of my questions.
Did it transfer?
At the desk, if it would transfer, and he had to call some people to make sure that it would, because I wasn't ready to go through with that transition until I knew that it would, and it did. Yeah. So I have that still, so I, you know, maybe possible.
That's a common thing that people have is text message threads.
Yeah.
People don't want to lose these text message threads. Those are domains, and those are real things. I have goosebumps sitting here talking about this because, and I'm sure your listeners probably do too, because there's a lot of people that are like holding on to some little, what's called a NARB. A NARB is the term for an individual piece, like an individual domain. They're called NARBs.
What about the role that other family members might play in discussions about what's best for these digital remains? Let's say you've got a family in conflict.
Yeah.
You know, one brother wants to do this with dad's Facebook and another wants to do something else with this or that platform. How do those situations get resolved?
These conflicts pop up all the time. And in the U.S., yesterday you guys had the sharenting discussion. There's this idea of the right to be forgotten, which is more common in Europe and I think Argentina, where the idea is that you have a right to delete stuff from your past that's online. Okay? We don't really have that in the U.S. We don't really have this like established legal precedent. So in cases, there's a case that I know of where you had parents that got divorced and had kids. The husband died suddenly, the ex-husband, and has a girlfriend. He dies suddenly, but the girlfriend has access to his Facebook account. She doesn't want to close it, and so she is posting and using his account to communicate to people that he was friends with. And the children are like horrified by seeing posts coming up from their dead dad's Facebook page. That causes what we would call complicated grief. But legally, the person with password access owns it. They have access. So that's where we are.
And Lewis, I imagine that even though we know that funerals can bring people together, they can reconnect over this tragedy, that there are conflicts that surround the passing of relatives. Maybe they're fighting over material things. Maybe just being together rekindles old wounds. How does your industry help people deal with just the external family conflicts that are just brought up because someone has passed?
So licensed funeral professionals are also pseudo-counselors. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that they are trained to do is to listen. And they should be also highly emotionally intelligent in terms of reading body language, listening to cues of dysfunction, and be prepared for it. And ultimately, mortuary schools do train on this aspect of things, but experience will help you deal with that over time. And in my specific arena, I will always try to pull the family together, ask them if they need to take a couple minutes to digest the information that they're discussing, and even more so, let's focus on what we need to do and accomplish it.
Mm-hmm. We got a comment on Facebook from Samantha Stryker. She says Facebook offers an option to have a friend or family member to access or delete your account. However, I'm not sure if they include Instagram or WhatsApp into this access. It's now been named Trusted Contact. So that's an option that you have where you can say, this is a person, should something happen to me, they can have.
Yep. And then if you die, they get access. And do you know why we have that now in the U.S. on Facebook? So in 2007, the Virginia Tech shooting, that was the first time that we had to sort of deal with, oh, we have deceased people online. And that's when Facebook memorialized those pages instead of deleting them. And then that really was like a significant moment in Thanos technology and how we're going to handle dead people online. Because if you think about in 2007, the internet was really like young still. I mean, Facebook was only started in 2004. So we have to also keep in mind and keep context that this is very new stuff. It's baby. It's a toddler. It's not fully developed.
Well, on the context of trusted contacts mm-hmm. within your social media, I'm wondering if your social media should be treated like a will. You know, you mm-hmm. prepare before you die that this is where things are going. This is what's to happen to this and that and to me. Do you need to include a social media strategy in your plans for death?
Yes, you can. And there are people who have. Actually, Robin Williams had some specifics listed out in his will or whatever that dealt with how his image could or could not be used in the future. So there's something that we have called digital zombies. And this is when dead people show up long after. For example, there was a commercial with Fred Astaire in a vacuum cleaner commercial, Steve McQueen in a Ford Mustang, Tupac Shakur, Michael Jackson doing concerts years after they had died. Who owns that? And what would they have, what would Fred Astaire have really thought? You know, because now we have licensing and, you know, trademarks. And so it's this huge gray area between if someone is a public figure, how long after they are dead are they still a public figure? And how can that be used?
Is that something that you see, Lewis, that people have prepared? I know you don't do will preparation. That's for the legal side of mm-hmm. things. But in their preparations for planning what happens in the afterlife, which would certainly include your services at a funeral home, have you heard of people who have implemented these types of strategies?
Definitely. So actually, my wife and I have met with a lawyer to go through our will and final mm-hmm. wishes because we have young children. And mm-hmm. it's important for us to make sure that we have our affairs in order so that the discussion is ours and the decision is ours. And so yeah. I would ultimately definitely have that conversation with an attorney or someone who can draw something up to make sure that the social media aspect of things and your digital remains are properly cared for.
One of the challenges with the social media and death is that sometimes families lose the control mm-hmm. about who controls the announcement of
yes.
someone's passing. And that's really anything that you can set in your settings.
Yes, because you ultimately can't control other people. And we also don't really have sort of etiquette standards, so to speak, in place in the U.S. We don't have social norms for all of this stuff because it is so new. As an example, there was a woman whose 13-year-old son died by suicide. And in the days after, she kept getting all these YouTube notifications because all of her son was involved with online gaming community, and all these kids all around the world were putting up these like video tributes and sharing pictures and photos of her son that she had never seen. And so she was kind of like horrified by finding this whole other side about her son that she had no idea about. And she only found out about it after he had died. And so for grievers, germains can really, really complicate the grieving process and the idea of who we thought we knew, right? You would think that you would know your son, but then to be faced with all the stuff you didn't, that can be just a debilitating experience.
I referenced earlier this Oxford study about digital remains. It was published in Nature magazine. Mm-hmm. And one of the quotes that I pulled from it that I thought was quite interesting is, "Much like digital remains, archaeological and medical exhibit objects such as bones and organic body parts are both displayed for the living to consume and difficult to allocate to a specific owner.
Yeah.
As exhibits have become increasingly mm-hmm. digitalized and made available online, the ethical concerns of the field appear to be increasingly merging with those of the digital afterlife industry." So isn't that interesting that the more traditional form of archaeology
yep.
is blending with this new form of archaeology, this digital archaeology, where we're leaving all these fossils and remnants behind?
Yes. There's people called data hoarders, where they actually, their goal is to just collect other people's online and digital materials and just save it and just archive it because we're not sure how we're going to use it in the future.
Dual certified thanatologist Cole Imperi and Linneman Funeral Homes and Cremation Center president and owner Lewis Linneman, thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.